This is Paul McGann.
The Eighth Doctor, you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus.
I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
Hi, I'm Zuby from Magic with Zuby, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Witten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Keir Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning.
Welcome to episode 281 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we've traded our frocks for scarves, our smirks for grins, and James Bond panache for Mad Hatter unpredictability. Lordy lord, we are in for a time. I'm Keir.
I'm Haley.
And I'm Jay, and this week we spring to new life in a new, invigorated, and notably more insane era of Doctor Who with the long-awaited emergence of Tom Baker as the Fourth Doctor in Robot.
And joining us for this momentous occasion is the host and producer of the Reality Bomb and Deeper Cuts podcasts, as well as author of the Sidney Newman biography, Head of Drama, Graham Burke. Welcome to GPR.
Why, thank you. Hello.
It's great to have you in here at long last, Grant. One of the things that we always like to do when we start into our classic rewatches is just go around the horn really quickly and find out what kind of familiarity everybody has with the story on the table. I will just back out of this quickly because this is one that is, this is essentially my, you know, Saturday night popcorn, one of my Saturday night popcorn stories. So I've watched this more times than I can probably count. So I'll tap out of it, but I'll look to Haley and see. Haley, is this your first watch?
Yes.
Or have you seen this?
This is the first time I've seen this episode.
Okay. Good, good, good. Jay, I pretty much know the answer to this one, but for the record.
I've seen it at least once. I don't know if I've seen it multiple times, but at least once, yes.
Okay, okay. And Mr. Burke, sir.
I'm afraid there's a short anecdote attached, but to do this quickly, I videotaped Robot on my new VCR in 1985 and then was unable to really successfully tape any other Doctor Who story off of PBS for a long time. So consequently, Robot is probably the most watched Doctor Who story I have ever seen because it was simply the Doctor Who story I had on videotape for the longest.
So one of those ones, until the tape snaps. Yep, got it. All right. Well, if that being the case, obviously this is a transitional period for the program as well. Maybe not as momentous as what we're headed into right now with series 13, heading into series 12, but nonetheless, a lot of changes of hands, or at least transitions of hands from production to crew to cast and all points in between. But we always want to make sure that we're kind of staying close and comfortable with the story itself. So obviously we're dealing with our baddies here in the form of the Nazis. I mean the Scientific Loser Society,
Hail Hydra,
and their that old chestnut, and their approach to global overthrow. I wanted to sort of see here amongst you whether you felt that there was a really prominent B story as well. And I'm gonna just stick a slight fork in the road here and say that I'm not considering the regeneration of the Doctor as a B story per se. I would see that as a factor affecting all plot lines within the story proper. But were we dealing with a second plot line here that really is of note?
You know, it did seem like they were trying to put one in there, but it was. Most of the time, it was all pretty much like, here, focus on this thing that's in front of you, and we'll get to the other one when we can.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I don't know if it felt like there was a B story, really.
Okay. Well, I've floated the idea. I wasn't entirely certain whether we were going to be dealing with a slight conversation about the idea of, well, Terrence Dick's take on Asimov's laws of robotics, you know, and that idea of the sentience of the machine, so that he could deal with these moral quandaries, you know, all the times. Any opportunity where the robot was going to get into arm spinny mode and dealing with the I can, I can't, we might have been dealing with something a little deeper here. Graham, did you feel that we had a sort of the development of a second storyline in that respect?
I think it pretty much linearly develops one from the other. I don't really feel it's a B story per se. I think, but I do. I mean, I think there's a pretty solid progression to get from what, you know, starts as an Avengers story and then ends as a pastiche of King Kong. So, it transitions between one to the other very seamlessly.
Yeah, I laughed out loud when he picked her up.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
And put her on the tower.
Yeah. We sort of painting an inch thick on that one, thanks to Mr. Dix. But there was from a technical aspect, I will say that actually jogs memory, the fact that we were dealing with some steps forward in corrections to some of the Invasion of the Dinosaurs CSO issues that were so that plagued the previous season so horribly. Now that they were going to the idea of not only using videotaping in studio, but for some of their exterior and location shots, they actually went to videotape specifically so that their CSO overlay would not look quite as jarring. They still hadn't quite figured out how to match lighting or the fact that the robot was rather reflective,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
and would pick up on the blue screen that was behind it, so its legs disappeared often. But details. But the obvious point that everybody wants to start to dive into on the story is obviously the first opportunity to really get to know, or what you think you know, of Tom Baker as our fourth Doctor. And just right out of the gate, you know, we are warned that a forced regeneration at the hands of our benevolent Time Lord previous tutor of the Doctor was going to have its issues,
mm-hmm.
and it clearly did. He woke up babbling.
Yeah, and then proceeded to, like, completely forget everybody that he knew.
Did he, though?
Well, it took him a minute to remember everything. He was very focused on, like, oh, hey, I want to leave. I'm going to go ahead and go now.
He kind of had to get caught up on his own timeline, it seemed like.
Okay. I'm wondering how everybody sort of accepted the processing of what was going on there. You know, because we didn't have to deal with any sort of necessary rest. You know, which is something that we were given in a previous regeneration.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have quite the same duration of, let's take Capaldi's regeneration, where he's completely out of sorts for a long stretch in Deep Breath, you know, where it's not just a matter of unfamiliarity, it's a matter of really needing to distance himself from everything, just unable to cope. This was, I think, a very interesting way of straddling the line between the sort of the discombobulation and just letting him run off in a direction and do his thing, because he's clearly, even when he's out of sorts, he's still the most intelligent being in the room.
Yeah.
So you might just have to let him be. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an obvious result of the fact that this is now the fourth Doctor and the third time that we've seen the Doctor change his face. So when Spearhead from Space happened, it was, you know, the Doctor was, there's still quite a novelty to the whole idea of a changing lead to your series. And they wanted to, you know, really milk the drama for all it's worth, especially since they're reformatting the series too. I think with Robot, everything else is pretty much now fixed. The mooring, you know, the guest cast is pretty much fixed. The unit setup is pretty much fixed. Sarah is pretty much fixed. So they have the freedom to do something different this time. And so I think the first thing they do is they play up the comedy aspect of it more and they give the Doctor a key speaking part throughout, which is vastly different, as you said, to Spearhead from Space. But I think it also is I think a testament to the fact that they now know that, you know, the Doctor changing his form and changing his personality is de rigueur for the show. And in fact, you know, it had only been 2 years before on the same the Doctor's lab set that the Doctor encountered his previous incarnation. So I think it's a result of a format that's become much more well established.
Okay. Speaking of those sort of formats, or at least some things that we had started to become kind of familiar and comfortable with, you mentioned Sarah Jane as being sort of a fixed point at this, but we're now we immediately start to get to see how she can interact with this new iteration of the Doctor, coming right off the heels of our previous story. I mean, I might not want to use Planet of the Spiders as indicative of the kind of third Doctor Sarah Jane relationship, but maybe to a certain degree it still applies. Haley, as a getting to see these things and seeing those character interactions for the first time through, are you noticing anything different with the way Sarah Jane is, or even just from an actor's perspective, how Elizabeth Sladen was handling work with Tom Baker as opposed to work with Jon Pertwee on screen?
I mean, chemistry just from the beginning, it seems friendlier. There's not the harshness to the relationship that you saw with Pertwee.
Okay, Jay, do you feel a noticeable shift, or is it just something where it's a matter of, okay, two different actors, different relationship?
No, it does feel like almost as if this Doctor was the one that Sarah was supposed to be with the whole time. Like, they hired her on expecting this kind of Doctor for her.
Okay. Graham, did you ever have any sort of insight into this as far as the Sladen Pertwee versus the Sladen Baker relationship on screen and off?
I do, but for me, I perceive it in later stories. I think I would more be saying the same things just said more for the relationship in Ark and Space than they don't actually interact much in Robot. It's actually there's actually surprisingly few scenes between them. I think the one at the very end where the Doctor and Sarah are talking about, you know, the robot, you know, having you know, potential for great good and not, that is a really lovely tender scene that would be very different than how it would have played out with Pertwee, I think. And so yes, I think that's a sequence where you really get to see it. But otherwise, I think it's a story where Sarah shows tremendous strides and growth, but it's more on her own. The beginning of episode 2, where she basically, you know, faces the robot and then realizes it's a practical joke, and it starts out being somewhat jokey with Jellicoe and Winters, and then all of a sudden it pivots as soon as you realize how nasty Winters is, and the way Liz Sladen plays that scene, and she moves into more and more sarcasm and more steel. And I love that scene. I think it's a great scene for Sarah, but it's a scene almost independent of the Doctor whatsoever.
That's true. Yeah, it is a great advancement for Sarah Jane as a character as well. I mean, we get to see, this is probably where we get to see some of her most intrepid journalist skills, the real, you know, I'm going to get to the heart of the story if I'm putting my own self at risk for doing so.
She shows all kinds of different facets to get there. I mean, she flirts with the Brigadier in episode 1 outright. Okay. It's which is one of the most charming things in the story, actually.
So we're mentioning obviously some of our lead adversaries here as far as dealing with Winters and Jellicoe. I think I'm fascinated by this strange, I'm going to include Kettlewell in this as well, because that idea of this professor, you know, sort of double agent thing that had everyone fooled throughout, and I think was really rather adeptly handled in the story, as far as the you know, it being Sarah Jane's idea to bring him along to the SRS meeting and things when you know, he was really an insider all along. I think that was actually a really interesting piece of script work by Dix, rather clever in that inclusion, and I'm willing to bet that he cost the vast majority of the viewing audience off guard by that.
Oh yeah.
Haley, how did that little reveal play out for you?
I'm trying to think if I was caught off guard or not, because he was kind of a shifty character, you know? So, but that could have just been chalked up to his eccentricities.
And that hairstyle.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I kept expecting him to try and, like, run off screen to try and take down Sonic or something.
Yeah, I think I expected him to do something...
Yes, he is the... Yeah.
I think I expected him to do something kind of, you know, I don't know, bad, but not, you know, for evil purposes, just on accident to bumble into some bad stuff.
It almost seems as though that they were still attempting to do that with the character throughout. You know, he had, you know, it was the ends and the justification of the means that the doctor calls him out on, was something that maybe he did not see the fullest scope of what he was getting, or what he was setting in motion by even honoring these baddies in the slightest, and offering the use of his developments. But Winters I found to be a particularly fascinating character, because in all of the interviews that you can catch on the DVD releases and things of that sort, and I know, Graham, you've probably seen these as well, as far as Patricia Maynard's speaking out of the role, she could not go far enough with the character. You know, she was attempting to make this thing larger than life, you know, and just be as nearly a caricature as possible, and yet it was still within the scope of what she could have gotten away with this villainous character.
It's such an interesting... I mean, the character writing is it's such a bizarre kind of melange at this point, because you start out with her being kind of, you know, a scientist who's got some shady dealings, and then you end with her being, I don't know, Einstein as Hitler. It's a very, well, played like Margaret Thatcher. It's a very kind of weird thing, and it's the point at which I think... charitably, I think Terrence Dix runs out of a bit of runway and decides, okay, I'm just going to steal Holus Bolus from my Avengers story, The Mauritius Penny, which has the SRS, the whole SRS scene, you know, the idea of a neo-Nazi organization, you know, yeah, it steals very, liberally from that. And I think it's shoehorning Winters Angelico into that mode that it stretches the plausibility of the story. I find it still so highly damn enjoyable. I don't really care, but I do find that it is an aspect that the more I watch it, the more it grates on me just slightly, really? Just a tiny bit. Yeah. Because I think it's obvious she's a nasty piece of work. I actually like how the character is set up. It's just that suddenly you have to suddenly believe that there's this shadowy organization of scientists that are about to go blow up the world and blackmail people and make women wear dresses. And you're just kind of going, where did all this come from?
Yeah. It did escalate rather quickly. Yeah. Well, and then obviously, I think it was a matter of, I felt that as we get into the later stories, that Alec Lindstedt as Jellicoe starts to get marginalized. We don't get enough from a really interesting kind of character and a great performance. I would have loved to see more from him as the lead crony, but alas, just doesn't work out that way. I will say that as far as some of the things that I think are exemplary for what we do get out of supporting characters in this story, and I don't think I'm going to have to fight any of you on this. This is probably Benton's best story, hands down.
Yeah.
All right, because I'm just gonna stand on that one, because I mean, John Levine is just a larger than life character, and to see him now, you know, getting shedding his stripes, getting his step up in rank. And his gaining a little bit more respect from the brig as far as, you know, some field direction and things of that sort. He was just delightful throughout. And it hurts me to a certain degree to know that both for Courtney and Levine, that this is a bit of a last hurrah. I mean, granted, it's not the last time we see them on screen, but as far as this extent to their roles, This is the close of a very big UNIT era, as we knew it. And I'm really glad to see that at least Benton's character, I don't think the Brig got as much of a nice little bow tied on it as he could have or should have had. But this was a really strong one for Benton. Anyone else?
I think one of the things that where this is where having Terrence Dix writing it shines, I think. I think it's his first Doctor Who he's ever had to write. I mean, he's obviously written lots of Doctor Who stories, just never under his own name. But I think this is the first one that's gone out under his own name. And I do think it's a fusion of a couple of different Avengers stories. But I do think but I do think where he really, you know, is able to bring his sort of knowledge of the series to bear is that he does such sympathetic portrayals of the UNIT characters. And, you know, you have the Brigadier saying, I just wish once we could, you know, find a menace that you could stop with bullets. And, you know, and there's the, could it be another alien invasion? Really? You know, so there's all these, he allows the actors to finally do the wink and nods that they probably were already doing in the rehearsal room already. And I think there's that kind of sort of, and I think there's similarly, I think with Benton's part, I think they just, you know, he's actually basically saying, well, you know, we got rid of Richard Franklin, and now I'm the only person who's really ranking to talk to Nick, so they promoted me. You know, so I mean, but it's not just story function. I think it's also just knowledge of the actors and giving them some meatier parts than usual.
Yeah. Jay, I know you've always been sort of with me on a Team Benton front there. So how did feel about his treatment through the story?
I feel like he actually had a lot more to offer this time because they weren't trying to divide it up between two different characters. But at the same time, he was able to stay Benton instead of like trying to get him to give some of the stuff that Yates would typically do. Like everything he delivered was him. So I thought it was a good deal.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then, obviously, on the supporting side, we've got Harry Sullivan. I mean, this is you talk about the start of another era.
Mm-hmm.
Ian Martyr's now with us in the character that we actually know him, so that we're not dealing with the carnival. we get Harry proper. Although, can I just ask around the table here whether you think there was anything. Sort of a meta joke made when Sarah Jane refers to him as being a little bit James Bond, and we're just coming off the Purge era.
Yes.
Do you think that was an inside joke?
Yes.
It has to be. I mean, they made too many comments before about how, behind the scenes kind of thing, where it was nodded to that he was inspired by James Bond. You know, they were trying to capture that popularity kind of thing. So I can't believe that they didn't intend that to be what it was.
But to give it to Harry Sullivan's character, or to say that he's the one that strikes you as being a little bit James Bond, I'm thinking to myself, I'm not seeing it. So this has got to be some sort of a shoehorned gag in here that they knew they were going to have to crack a James Bond joke sometime through this story. It's as good a place here as anywhere. Yeah, I think Harry gets off to a great start because we get to see quite a few facets of him. We get to see him try to be, a little bit of a sneak. You get to see him try to, you know, push his weight around. You get to see him try to impress people with his intelligence, only to find that he's clearly not the most intelligent.
He's woefully outclassed.
But just delightful. I know when I was going through and getting the fuller appreciation of the Baker era, because I had gotten it completely out of sequence as a kid when it was getting its PBS airing, at least here in the Northeast. So I didn't get my robot exposure for quite a while. I'd seen many other Fourth Doctor stories before I got a chance to see Robot. So I didn't get to see where Harry Sullivan came into it. I only got to see it when he started really becoming quite the whipping boy for the Fourth Doctor. Or just taking a barrage of abuse on a regular basis and didn't really see where the grounds for it were. But now, getting to see this, and I still think, and Grant backed me up on this, Harry does not deserve the slights that he receives.
No, I would tend to agree with that. I think Harry is much maligned. I don't think he does a lot that's particularly striking in this story. It's a very cursory kind of introduction to what is a very, at this point, a very comical character. I think he gets a much better workout in the next two stories. I think in Ark and Space and Genesis, and especially, Ark and Space, Centauran Experiment, and then especially in Genesis. I think you get much more to see what's cool about Harry. But yeah, he is, I think, a much maligned. But he doesn't actually get, aside from, you know, Sarah saying to him, you know, James Bond. I mean, no one's actually too particularly hard on Harry in this story, unfortunately. Right. Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, the doctor obviously thumps him and locks him up in a cupboard. There's lots of locking up of people in the cupboards in this story.
It's underutilized.
we need a piece more of furniture. Yes, exactly. So.
Just think the X-Files would have been a much different series if we just had more people being suspended in cupboards, I think.
And always tied upside down. That's the funny thing. Like,
well, add insult to injury. Literally insult to injury. All right.
But the thing is to thing with Ian Martyr is that he's got the comic chops. That's the hilarious part. The whole scene where the doctor ends up skipping with Harry is wonderfully done. And the way he bounces the dialogue with Tom Baker is brilliant. And then it culminates in skipping together. It is ludicrous, but it is glorious at the same time.
The kicker about that sequence is go back one more time and watch how long that take is.
Yeah.
There's no cuts. So there's about 3.5 to 4 minutes of dialogue before the doctor picks up the jump rope. So I don't know how many takes they would have even allowed that to, you know, they would have just experimented with before they finally said, you know what, you got 3 hops out of it, and then we're just going to fluff the dialogue for the remainder of it, and we're going to let it go. But
I imagine it was worked out in the rehearsal room very thoroughly by two people who knew what they were doing in terms of that sort of work, I suspect.
Color me impressed, though, because that scene worked out beautifully. So from a behind the scenes aspect, obviously, you know, with Dix handing over the editing rights to Robert Sloman at this point, but he decided that he wanted to hold on to be the primary or at least the credited writer for this one. As you mentioned, Graham, that he, you know, obviously as a as story editor, he had probably had his pen in the ink more often than the people who actually had their name on the title cards. But the fact that he tried to tell the rest of the production crew that it was, well, this is the way it's done. You know, when a story editor hands over to another, he writes the first episode for the other as a transitional gesture.
Sure he does. Wink, wink.
Yes, of course. This sounds like a very Stephen Moffat thing to do. I think it would have been a nice gesture if he had told Chibnall, yep, great, you're going to, fantastic, it's all yours, here's your keys to your desk. Here's your parking space pass, and by the way, I'll be writing your opener.
Also, because you're next in line, you have to give me 10% of all your money. It's just, it's how it works. It's in the contract if you really want to dig that out.
Don't forget the residuals. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, let's face it. I mean, you know, Terrence Dix never forgot what it was like to be a freelancer. And when you're a freelancer, you figure out what opportunities you can to get further work. And to be fair, Robert Holmes did the exact same thing about 4 years later. I mean, he leaves, and who's writing the first story when Anthony Reed, it's
right, yeah.
Because he thought that's how you did it.
So Dix was right. It is tradition. It was just a tradition he was starting right there and then. But traditions have to begin somewhere. And then we're seeing obviously the last opportunity for Barry Letts to take the producer's slot before Philip Hinchcliffe moves into the position. So interesting transition there, which dramatically changes, I think, a lot of the experimentation of things to come, or at least some of the depth of the storylines. I think the writing, or at least the attention to some of the story development, and not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but Haley, I think you're going to pick up on a lot of this. There's a definite shift in the pace and the tightness of the script.
Mm-hmm.
So, Haley, you might have to start to put aside your which one of the episodes is left out on the curb in the cold, because you might not be able to as often.
Okay.
As you have historically. So just be cognizant of that. I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. But Graham, on that note, this is something that we'll let you inside on this. Obviously, as we were getting into the anything exceeding a 4-episode story, especially when we're getting to some of the 6 or the odd numbers here and there, we always felt that there was a point where if it weren't just a single episode, at least you could do some tightening and some fat trimming and still condense it down to a 4-episode story that would have been a lot peppier, for lack of other. But would you say that maybe under Hinchcliffe's eye, that this may not continue, or that you might not be as ready to say, that third episode felt like they just took a snooze or what have you?
I think that really comes to bear in about a season's time, but I think yes. But I think that's partially because Robert Holmes's idea with doing a 6-part story was that it's a 4-parter and a 2-parter. Mm. And it's a question of where you sneak in the 2-parter. Do you sneak it in at the end? Do you sneak it in the middle? Do you sneak it in at the beginning? You know, Seeds of Doom is at the beginning. Talons of Wen Chiang is at the end. You know, Genesis of Daleks is sort of in the middle. You know, so it's a sort of an interesting way he sort of. But it is a very kind of it actually pretty much changes how 6-episode stories are done. It becomes less about the padding and more about how do we stitch 2 disparate stories together. I think in terms of the 6-parters. Yeah. But yeah, I do think you're right. I do think even the 4-part stories become much tighter under Holmes, and you know, Philip Hinchcliffe didn't produce this episode, but he was job shadowing Barry Letts at the time, so he was in the room for most of the decisions and saw them being made. So, and I think you can sort of see him hit the ground running with the next episode because everything is in place and going.
I'm trying to remember. I know at this point, obviously, he was there through the rehearsal process, and as you mentioned, he was sort of shadowing Letts throughout. But had he, what was his capacity in anything prior to this point, or were they really bringing him into this particular project out of the cold?
My conversations with Philip about this are that he did sort of, I think he was around for Planet of the Spiders bit, and he was around for maybe Monster Peloton. But it was very, and so was Robert Holmes at that point. Robert Holmes was already actively. Robert Holmes was around for the last, I think, from Death of the Daleks onwards. So there was some overlap. The decision to cast Tom Baker was made by Barry Letts and Terrence Dix in consultation with Bill Slater, who was head of serials at the time. So there was a very, you know, so in some, the most crucial respect, who are you casting as your leading man? And even casting, and even creating Harry Sullivan and casting Ian Martyr, all those decisions were made by Barry Letts. Barry Letts famously, I mean, you probably already know this here, was thinking about trying to do what Stephen Moffat did later with Peter Capaldi and cast an older actor in the role, following John Pertwee. And he thought, well, if that's the case, then I need to create a sort of Ian Chesterton figure again and have a younger figure who can get the Doctor out of scrapes and stuff. Well, his ideas of who to cast as an older actor quickly kind of ran aground. He had I think Richard Hearn, who played played a character called Mr. Pastry, and he thought he and Hearn was famously so doddery he thought he was being asked for his character to play Doctor Who. That didn't quite work. And I think his other choice, I think, it was Fulton McKay. And Fulton McKay didn't choose it and went with doing Porridge instead, which probably was the making of his career. So I think as a result, that fell aground, but he had already hired Ian Martyr. So Ian Martyr was now in the mix for the rest of the season, even though the need for a character like Harry was no longer, it was surplus to requirements in many respects.
Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, suited the chemistry quite well for the TARDIS team to follow. All right. Well, we always like to culminate these conversations about our classic stories with a bit of a quick go round on the rewatchability and the recommendability of the stories going forward for individuals who, rewatchability obviously for ourselves and our own personal enjoyment, and recommendability for those individuals who maybe at least have a cursory understanding of Classic Who and are looking to either work on expanding their understanding of a particular Doctor's iteration or just classic episodes in general, or classic stories in general, I should say. So, Haley, where are you on the Great Divide here?
Definitely rewatchable. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. And you have to recommend it because it's a new Doctor's first story. You can't not watch this. And it's very enjoyable, like I said. So recommend, watch, rewatch, all thumbs up.
Yep, stick it under your pillow. Yep, everything. Wonderful. All right, Jay?
I'm just going to echo Haley. Yeah, it's definitely rewatchable. Had a lot of fun with it. The dialogue in it is so much fun. And you know, the little winks and nods and stuff, just it keeps everything entertaining, even when the story might drag a little bit for you. But honestly, I had no problem just plowing straight through the story. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Yeah, it's a bit of academics here, but Graham, I think you're probably safe to say rewatchability is there for you.
I was trying to do a rough estimate of how many times I've seen this story, and I think I'm around somewhere around 37, 38.
In a row? Maybe.
No. But, you know, in a 34-year period, I think I've seen this story maybe, you know, 39, maybe 40 times. So, okay. Yeah. So yes, definitely rewatchable. Mm-hmm. And recommend, oh, yes, absolutely. If not, for another reason, then, to see Tom Baker. I think we didn't get a chance to really say about him in particular, but I think Stephen Moffat once made the observation about season 12 stories is that you can sort of see Tom Baker as this unknown actor sort of exploding into being, the same way Matt Smith did in his first season, or Benedict Cumberbatch did in the first season of Sherlock. And it's you're watching Tom Baker sort of invent the role in front of you. This is what really struck me this time. You know, the very way, the very posture and the physicality with which Tom Baker plays the role, it's an acting part for him. It's not a personality part. It's an acting job. He's actually thinking about how should the Doctor stand in particular scenes, and the way that he lies down, and you know, it's just fascinating to me just watching him develop
all
that physicality.
All the choices. Yeah, putting his feet up on everything in the room. Those sort of things. All of these choices that have to do with him really defining the character. And I think it's always interesting to know that we all feel that we know the Fourth Doctor. We all have this image in our heads of this iconic madman that just pervades everything. But you have to keep reminding yourself, this is the first time he's doing this. And yet there are choices and there are decisions and there are things that he's experimenting with here that he maintains and that he locks in that remain throughout. The toying with the scarf, the mussing with the hat, the feet up on everything, the occasional, well, the naps in the middle of these hectic situations, and he's just going to catch 10 minutes of Z's because he's contemplating something, and he does it better when he's, you know, kicking back. And so, this is all genius.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of little things he's doing, little bits of stage business he's doing that are just really, really quite clever. And there's lines where he's being asked, you know, to sort of ponder something that, you know, you know that how John Pertwee would do it is just a perfectly straight answer to the question. Maybe even rub the back of his neck for effect. But you know, I mean. Baker answers it as though it's an alien talking. It's I'm going to stare off into the middle distance and just seem just a bit off kilter. And it's a wonderful touch, but you're realizing that he's actually making this up as he goes along, and it's really brilliant.
Yeah. So you might as well go ahead and get yourself your DVD set and get 3 to 4 replacements for it, because you're going to be rewatching this often enough that you're probably going to need to replace scratch discs or, you know, lock it in digitally. This is a must own. I mean, as far as I think everyone here is pretty much concerned. All that being said, and we'll sort of snap the lid down on this one. But Graham, if you can indulge us, we want to play a little game with you, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure.
Well, you know, when we've got someone new to the GPR studios here, we want to play a little game of 5 rounds rapid. Just a couple of questions, sure, 5 of them, sure, to be exact, that we can just throw at you and get to know your Whovian scope a little better. Okay. Haley, why don't you take the first one?
All right. What was your entry point into Doctor Who?
Pyramids of Mars, Episode 2.
Okay.
And I did a whole documentary about it on Reality Bomb, episode 1012. So yeah.
Okay. All right, Jay.
All right. So forget about your doctor. Who is your companion?
Sarah Jane Smith. Easily. Okay. You know, first of all, I fancied her rotten when I was 14 years old. Secondly, she is just amazing in every single possible respect. So yeah, no question. Answer.
All right. Let's see. Here's an interesting one for you. Single bottle episodes, multi-story arcs, or full season arcs.
Okay. Well, you're gonna have to repeat that question. I'm missing the thread. Oh. Sorry.
Okay, so yeah, the Skype is acting a little up right now. Bottle episodes, multi-story arcs, or full-season arcs?
Which do I prefer of them?
Yep, you're perfect.
Full-season arcs. And honestly, you know, I am as surprised as the rest of you about that. But for me, one of the greatest joys of watching Series 1 was actually getting to midway through... midway through Parting of the Ways and going, I have no idea how this is going to end. And I have no idea where this is going to go. And I thought that was so cool. So yeah, story arcs.
Interesting. Okay.
What are your greatest expectations for Series 11?
That it makes me laugh. So there you go. If Doctor Who can make me laugh, then we're good. I think that's all I really... I am remarkably... My threshold for what I will expect Doctor Who to do is to entertain me. And I think there are sometimes fans have these ridiculous expectations that it'd be the greatest drama that it's ever been invented and it must be super awesome and every single episode must be super awesome. No, it doesn't. You can't do television that's super awesome every episode. You can do entertaining episodes, you know. So I love entertaining episodes. For me, I knew that the Peter Capaldi era was going to work when I saw Time Heist. It was like, it's not a super awesome episode. It is a highly entertaining episode. Just do that, guys, and we're going to be great for another 3 years. So, yeah, same case applies here.
Awesome. Okay.
All right, so the Doctor shows up in the TARDIS, steps out, and says, all of time and space, where do you want to go?
Oh, easily. The BBC Television Center in 1975, so I can pick up all the missing episodes. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's the stereotypical answer, but frankly, it is precisely true.
No, that's, you know what, and we would all be in your debt as a result. All right. Well, Jay, do you think it's time to crank up the newsreel?
I think it is.
Couple of items here. It's been a little bit of a quieter week as we sort of brace ourselves to see what the next development is from what's been going on in the current production block. Mm-hmm. But did notice an interesting little piece that Russell T. Davis has been a little bit more prevalent in the media lately, obviously with the publication of his newest Target novelization. But I got a chance to sit down and speak with Doctor Who magazine. And gave a little clarification about some earlier statements that he had made about the casting of a female doctor and what he, you know, may have thought in the past and how he feels he has grown up, you know, on that decision.
Backpedal.
Jay Haley, did you get a chance? Yep. did either of you get a chance to look over this article?
Yeah, and it's really interesting when you read it because... He kind of calls himself out, goes, yes, I was loud and obnoxious about it. You know, I shared my opinion, but I've grown up since then. And the world has grown up since then, too. Like, he was talking about how it's at the time it was going to be difficult to try and explain to kids what switching genders and stuff like that would be like. And honestly, nowadays, that's not as big an issue. So I can kind of understand where he was coming from at the time and how that's changed drastically since then. But yeah, it's. I mean, he's right. He's come a long way since then, and the world really has too.
Interesting to note too, and this is something that he actually spells out. This is a matter of 13 years, but he stresses that he's like these are 13 long years. A lot of things have happened in terms of our societal awareness and just our concept of what has to become more of the common vernacular, part of our awareness and sensitivities. So for him to make that admission, obviously we think, okay, well, this is par for the course. This is something that everybody is starting to own up to, I would think, or at least hopefully. But the fact that he's doing so and really condemning his former self is an interesting statement. The fact that it's RTD and it's just his particular personality and everything goes along with it just makes for a more interesting conversation to begin with. You'd have to go back and really look at the original Guardian interview to see the kind of the tone, the I wouldn't really call it haughtiness or anything of that sort that was in the original statements. He might be a little hard on himself as far as the way he's looking back, but that's self-criticism. That's him saying, you know what, it was my own ignorance, in essence. He realized that these worries weren't maybe necessarily his. It was a matter of more of a concern of what the societal norms were going to accept, and he didn't want to, because he had the pressure of bringing this program to light and making as much of a success out of it as possible, that he felt that he needed to play it safe in that regard. I don't really know. But I am glad that he's willing to come forward and discuss it as such, and that these conversations will continue. Graham, are you familiar with everything that's been going on with the book?
Yeah, I have. But you know, and to a certain extent, my attitude was kind of like, well, you know, guy in 2005 turns out to have attitudes from 2005. This is not exactly what I call newsworthy. In some ways, I mean, my own attitudes in 2005 towards the idea of a woman doctor were vastly similar to Russell T. Davies. I think a lot of Doctor Who fans have been on a journey for the past 13 years to get to this point, and I think there's a lot of points on the way. You know, it was only about 4 years ago when confronted by the question of whether or not to, you know, bring a woman doctor, you had Stephen Moffat making jokes about, well, you know, maybe Matt Smith could play the Queen after Helen Mirren. Like, you know, I mean, it was still a hot button topic even when Peter Capaldi was cast. So I'm not surprised, and I was pleased. I mean, that's one thing I've always loved about Russell, is that he's always had a certain degree of transparency about him, and has been willing to sort of admit when he's felt that mistakes were made, or he didn't, or he would do something differently now, and that's one of the reasons why I love him so. Hooray.
Yeah. I do like the fact that some of the things that are brought up in some of the comments and discussions, both in the Radio Times and people that have been discussing the DWM interview itself, were saying that it's, I think, along with some of the realizations that RTD was making about societal acceptance and those things, was also because of the fact that he notes about the concern about what are children going to ask and things of that sort, or those were some of the fears or trepidations that he had back in 2005, 2008 or so when the Guardian interview had happened, but the response in some of the comments were, have you ever had a conversation with a young child, like a particularly young child, and see how open-minded they are about everything? If you just give them just a basic explanation, they accept it, they listen, they process it, okay, they move on to the next thing. So if you tell them, okay, well, this is the doctor here, and he's the doctor, oh, and she's the doctor, and he's the doctor, and she's the doctor, and they're the doctor, the kid will just, they process it. Okay, great, got it, move on.
I've had that, I've talked about that on this show, exactly, my youngest child is just kind of like, you know, he can point out all the different actors, be like, that's the doctor, that's the doctor too, that's the doctor, and I can't get adults to grasp that concept.
So yeah, it goes back to one of the first pieces of advice that I had gotten when I was working with kids, when I was teaching, was, you know, you speak to them as adults, they will rise to meet you 9 times out of 10. It doesn't matter how young, you know, you're dealing with. Have adult conversations with them. Well, I don't mean adult conversations, but then go speak to them, you know, as fully developed, you know, minds, and they will step right up and have that conversation with you, and they may surprise you with some of the things that they're capable of processing and responding to. So, something that a full grown adult will not respond to is Mr. Peter Capaldi when it comes to social media. For those of you who are wondering why it is that anytime we're discussing our beloved PCAP on Twitter or things of that sort, we always have to hashtag him because we can't at reference him, is because he will never be on social media. The opening quote from this RT interview speaks volumes. Haley, could you quote this out loud for me, please? Because I love this.
Are you talking about the part right under the title?
Yeah, you right. Give me my subheader. Right. Yep.
It is often just the noisiest people making their useless opinions heard.
I love this. But the kicker to this is that if he actually did delve into social media for any period of time, he would realize how revered he is on just about every social channel that I can think of. It might not have been maybe two or season and a half ago, but after this past season, this past series, unequivocal. It's his choice. It's his choice. Yeah. You know, some prominent Whovian figures get chased off of social media with pitchforks, and others just choose not to step forward in the first place. I don't ever see that changing. He says, Eccleston does not have any social media accounts. Tennant does not. Smith does not. To this day, I would have figured at this point, maybe Matt Smith would have come around just because he's always been so sort of affable. You know, they'd have him on, you know, ask me anythings or things of that sort. So he appreciates it, or at least even during his tenure as a doctor. I figured by now, though, sort of stepping out of the same brightness of spotlights in his work on his current series, that he might be interested in, well, just seeing, you know, what kind of response he would get to his everyday passing thoughts or where he's buying his coffee and such. I don't know.
I'm not surprised by this in the slightest. I'm not surprised, but I look at someone like Simon Pegg, who was very much on Twitter for a long time and then just basically gave it up because it just hit a point where he just said, it's bringing out sides of me that I don't like. And I think, you know, Stephen Moffat left it very famously. There's a group of people who just know how popular they are, and they're good. John Sim, I know, stays on Twitter, but I know anytime Doctor Who ever comes up, he's complained about it. You know, fans will suddenly go at him and sort of say, you know, for a long time he was like getting a hard time about, well, why won't you ever play the Master again? And this is before Missy showed up, and it was obviously an irritant to him, and I kind of go, well, you know what. I don't blame any Doctor Who actor for saying, you know what, I've got better things to do with my time than be on social media. I mean, even Russell T. Davies has an Instagram account, and that is it, and that is all he does with it, you know. And Instagram is a much more, I think, sort of containable form of social media.
It has the feel of being a lot more of a single direction push format, yeah. But noting that Whitaker doesn't have a Twitter account either, and I believe any of the official Facebook profiles are all moderated by PR staff, so she can stay clear of that too.
That seems like a very British thing, though, to not have all the social media stuff.
Are you saying that just because we can't get John Barrowman to shut up?
So true.
I mean, you literally can't. It's physically impossible. But just another thing to watch for, I suppose. Well, Jay, what's going on for next week when we crack into 282?
Next week we're actually going to revisit one of the panels from Region Who, and this is one we've talked about a little bit on the show, the Impossible Pacifist.
Yeah, the premise behind the panel was the idea of the complexity of trying to maintain a truly pacifistic or altruistic character in a science fiction series, whether it be the Doctor or you could extend it out to other franchises as well. I've had a great panel joining Haley and I. We had Brian Biggs from the Whovian Running Club and a couple of other individuals. Irene Richard was there to join us as well, and just discussing the idea of this difficulty. Or I believe Joy was on the panel with us as well for discussing how the tendency is to create a character who begins with these altruistic goals, but it always seems to be the case that at some point that dissolves and they have to put their morality aside for the sake of, all right, if I have to get in the thick of it, I will. But can that be realistically maintained with a modern audience? Things of that sort. So it really led to a great discussion. So we'll be happy to share that with folks too. So one of a lot of pieces of content from the regen events that we'll be able to share with you in the weeks ahead.
Yeah. So definitely looking forward to that one. But
yeah. Graham, just before we wrap up here, just obviously we've been mentioning it throughout, but the many many ways that we can get more of your thoughts about the Whovian scope and otherwise.
Well, gosh, there's obviously me on Twitter, which is at Graham Burke, GRAEMEBURK. Of course, I've got this little podcast that I do with Joy Piedmont called Reality Bomb, which is on Twitter at Reality Bomb PC. And that's all one word. And you can find us at realitybombpodcast.com. So, yeah. Come by. We're happy to keep the conversation going when GPR is not talking. So there you go. Which, given that you're a weekly, given that we're a monthly program, is less often than you. But there you go.
Fit your words in edgewise whenever you can get them. Yeah. Every once in a while, we take a breath. Yeah. But thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you in.
It's been a pleasure being here.
All right. Well, this has been episode 281 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is just saying, you may not have noticed, Miss Sullivan, but I'm a bit old-fashioned myself.
And this is Scare saying, I must obey. I cannot obey. I must. I cannot. I must. I.
And this is Haley saying, make my monster grow!
We'll see you guys next week.
I'll see.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1-GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.